Hansen here from NFL Red Zone. I hope you're checking out 1 hour of 5 Yard Rush, one of the best podcasts on NFL football in the UK.
Hey, what's happening, Rush Nation? It is Murph here. There is no Stocks. Stocks has gone on a well-earned vacation. At least he's left it like until June and not like week one of the season like he did last season. So we'll take it. Hope you're resting well, sir. I know we spoke the other day and he's staying in a really, really lovely sort of ranchy place. And, you know, rather than listen to me, if you're watching the live stream, you know that I'm not alone. If you're listening to this on the podcast, very rarely I'm alone. And I always like to bring a good friend on to keep me company. And I have brought one of my absolute favorite friends of this industry on, and I'm glad that he's agreed to come on and keep me company this evening, as we've just been talking off air about the Euros and the big game tomorrow. But without further ado, my good friend, Pat Fitzmaurice of footballgirl.com, and also with Football Guys as of recently, as of the last time we spoke, and also the most accurate ranker on the planet as it stands right now. Pat, welcome back. Good to have you.
Murph, always good to talk to you. Miss seeing Stocks, but I know we're going to have a good time today.
Absolutely. We've got a lot to cover off. Without further ado, let's start with what's been going on since you, you know, since you were last on. Obviously, you've joined Football Guys. That's quite a newish thing since you last on. But what else has been going on? Pandemic and being at home. And what's new with you?
Yeah, so things have kind of opened up here. We seem to have things under control a little bit with the virus. I mean, vaccination rates, maybe not quite where we want them to be, but, you know, everyone seems to be maskless now, at least the vaccinated here, people with no pre-existing conditions. So things are pretty normal, but, you know, I've been working from home full time. So, you know, it's, in some ways, it looks a lot like it did during the pandemic with, you know, really not that much going on, but it has been nice to occasionally get back to a bar or a restaurant. I did miss that. And, you know, the paranoia about being around large groups of people is starting to dissipate a little. So I guess that's a good thing.
See, that's good. So obviously it's different. Every state is different. What's it? So were you saying big groups? Like how many people are allowed to meet up in a, I don't know, say a restaurant, a bar, or a public place? What's the limit in which people can meet up now? Or is there no real restrictions in place
anymore? Yeah, now I don't think there are many restrictions. I mean, they're back to being live music is happening again. There are Major League Baseball games and NBA playoffs games going on with no restriction as far as seating capacity. So things are pretty fully reopened here. And, you know, I haven't personally been in any really packed places yet, just basically pubs and restaurants with seating capacities of like, you know, less than 100 and probably far fewer people than that actually in the place. But, you know, there are some places and some venues where things are pretty crowded.
Yeah, I think it's starting to be, it's good to see. I have a lot of American friends from my time there. It's good to see people out and about and people sort of still taking a little bit of caution. And I think that's going to be there for a while for the most part. But it seems like people are embracing this life. And we're in a very similar-ish state here. We were supposed to open up on the 21st of June. We've got a lot of things open compared to what we did. We had a really long lockdown. Restaurants are open, pubs are open. There's a few little things not quite open, nightclubs, you know, for Lee likes to dance around and throw some shapes. And there's, you know, still reduced capacity at things. We have Wimbledon start today. They're at 50% capacity. The Euros is less than that. They're hoping to get up to 60,000 for the semi-final and the final, which will be very strange to see. But we have a new proposed date of the 19th of July is when we will be hopefully pretty open. And that's just due to the Delta variant which came from India. And it's just the infection rates are massively climbing. I look at the numbers now, and it was like a week and a half ago, it was at 6,000 a day. Now it's 23,000 a day. But the vaccinations are working. 82% of our population have had a first vaccine, or adult population. So the number of people going to hospital is relatively low. It's still in the hundreds, for example, of people that are in hospital with COVID, not the thousands and tens of thousands that we had. So the vaccines are working. So hopefully, as long as that stays normal, we'll be able to open up. But it does mean that at some point, we're all probably going to get COVID. So we'll see what happens. But it's a strange world. I'm glad that, you know, things are opening up there. Things are sort of coming to the end here. I know we've got listeners all over the world. And, you know, if you're not vaxxed, get vaccinated. Hopefully you do. If you don't believe in it, that's fine. But at the same token, just, you know, do what's right by you. I'm not going to get into a political stance because Cole Beasley's done that for most people. We can just leave him to talk about that. Let's talk about one of the reasons I wanted to get you on, other than the fact I just love having you on anyway, is we've been doing a kind of a masterclass of a lot of things recently. We've been doing a masterclass of best ball and dynasty and super flex and a lot of other things. And, you know, it would be reminiscent to bring on the number one ranker on the planet right now. And not talk about rankings because it's something that's been really interesting with our audience. Lots of people approach me about how to do projections. We're not going to talk about projections. We're going to stick to rankings. But just it'd be good to get a bit of an insight to people who are either doing rankings for the first time or have been starting to do them, because we get tons of questions. People are really interested in finding a good process. And since you're the guy reigning ranking champion and you've had many top five, top 10 finishes, what is a good place to start for people who are either looking to rank for the first time or have been doing it but looking to perhaps get a bit better at how they produce their rankings?
Sure. Well, first of all, good point that I am just temporarily the reigning champion. I know that's going to be fleeting, which is probably why my wife denied my request to have an iron throne installed in our living room. It's not happening. So, I guess to start with, at the non-quarterback positions, like, usage is king. Like, look for usage trends. Where are the targets going? How are players, look at targets, look at snap shares. How have teams been trending as far as how they use their players? Like, you're never going to get, nothing is static. Everything moves around a lot, but if you kind of study that stuff, you start to get a better idea. I do think, and this is something I learned over the years in rankings, that people tend to overplay defensive matchups and put too much emphasis on that. Just from watching other good rankers over the years, people I really respect as far as their rankings work, Sean Corner, John Paulson, Justin Boone, a bunch of other people who, you know, I really admire. I noticed that when I would be off from where they had a player ranked, if there was a discrepancy, you know, if I was kind of the outlier, it was often because I was overplaying defense and they were looking more at likelihood of touch volume. Likelihood of how many carries a player had been getting and not worrying so much about the matchup. And I would notice that more times than not, they were right and I was wrong. And over the years, I've kind of shifted my thinking on that. And generally, I think maybe it's our tendency to overmanage and want to be involved in that. But I do tend to think we get too excited about positive defensive matchups and too worried about tough matchups and make suboptimal decisions about starting lesser players because of that. And then just anyone who wants to rank, just dive in, start with quarterback, which is an easier position to do since, you know, if you're doing preseason rankings, there's usually just one guy to talk about on a team, maybe two if it's a transitional situation like the Bears or the 49ers or someone like that, or an ambiguous situation like the Saints. But just start and go through teams alphabetically or division by division and start stacking quarterbacks. You know, if you're doing it alphabetically, start with Atlanta and slot in Matt Ryan, and then Arizona's next. Do you like Kyler Murray more than Matt Ryan? Yes, you should. And then just keep doing that. And if you come to tough decisions, if it's Baker Mayfield versus Daniel Jones, dig into the numbers a little bit. Dig into what you think the run pass splits are going to be for a team in a given year. I mean, that's about it. There's a lot of nuance during the season. Injuries come into play. Weather might come into play. So many things. But, dive in and try it for yourself in pre-draft season, and don't rely on the so-called experts who get a lot of things wrong every year.
Absolutely. I think that's the first thing. Is everyone can pretend to be an expert. Everyone who says they're an expert gets things wrong all the time. If we were right all the time, there'd be no point in playing the games. It would be played on a simulator, and Madden would be more rich than it is now. But I think it's interesting. A lot of people come to me and say, I really want to do projections. And I'm like, okay, it sounds great. Like, I want to do projections, and I get it. And I don't try and dissuade people too much, but I do say it's a lot of work. To do projections takes weeks just to formulate them, let alone the tweaks. And the first time, second time, the third draft are all pretty, pretty rubbish. It takes me 3 months to formulate projections that I feel good enough to even share with stocks. Like, that's how long it takes me to produce a set of projections. I feel like I can actually share this with another human being, because it takes so much accounting. And I say to people, do rankings first, because at least with rankings, you can, you know, it's less about the finite margins, because you could literally project two players to be, you know, 0.1 of a fantasy point off. And you're sitting there like, well, actually, I thought this person would be above this person. And you've got them so infinitely close. And you're like, have I got that right? Well, maybe I need to go back and tweak. Whereas if your gut's telling you that, let's say Mecole Hardman, for example, is someone who should be in the top 50 wide receiver conversation, top 40 wide receiver conversation, maybe the fringe wide receiver 3 conversation, if that's how you feel, at least you, in a ranking, you can put him there. Like, you don't have to worry too much about, oh, well, I've got to look at his projections, and am I really sure? Is that right? Do the rankings first. I think it will help you with your process. And then if you do want to elevate and go to projections, at least once you've done that for a year or two, it will set you in good stead for the projection process. One of the questions I have around rankings, that I get this a lot, so I want to get this straight from you, is obviously we're trying to tell people to use tiers. Tiers is a good way of not being so linear in drafts and thinking, well, okay, I have to just go off my list of rankings and move across. And tiers give you that opportunity to sort of have a vertical board and a horizontal board. You might have one guy in one tier running back and you're on the clock, and you might have four guys in a wide receiver tier, and you think, well, which way do I go? How do you use your rankings to define your tiers? Because you obviously are looking at the players and you're thinking, okay, I think, you know, Hill's going to be up there in the top 3 wide receivers. And then how do you define the tiers in between? Do you look at previous scoring, previous performance, and previous and target shares? Or is it a bit a case of gut feel based on your years of experience? Like, how do you define the tiers?
It's mostly, like, I know some people like to do tiering where they group together similar types of players, certain profiles, like, you know, maybe with wide receivers, they group the sort of possession third down receiver. They group the Cole Beasley's, Jamison Crowder's, the third down slot receiver. I shouldn't say third down, slot receiver possession types together, or, you know, they have other sort of phylums, I guess, that they're grouping these players into. I just tend to do it as, like, I look for drop-off points. Where are certain bits of the rankings, parts where it's flat, where I don't necessarily care if I'm getting the running back five or the running back eight, because I think those four guys are very similar. And I'd almost rather be getting the last one, letting other people make that decision for me rather than taking the first one there. And I don't know that there are that many tiers for me. I guess at any position, maybe you can find, if it's a single onesie position, like quarterback or tight end, maybe there are two or three significant drop-off points where it, you know, the talent clearly goes down a level, and at running back and receiver, maybe it's four or five such points. But I think there are some clear spots where I think you just drop from one level to the next. The gap between players is larger than it is in other spots. And, you know, I just kind of like to highlight those areas for myself, and I should probably do more to make people aware of, you know, where I think those points are.
Because I think it's tricky. I especially look at the wide receiver position, and you could realistically have a tier around that sub wide receiver two into like the wide receiver four range. And you could have 20 guys yes. who could be split by 18 to 20 fantasy points realistically over a season. Like, it's so deep and at that point so thin that you could have realistically a tier there of 20 guys. It's not inconceivable, because it's so, I was going through my projections and I was looking and I was like, wow, I've gotten to the point where I've got wide receivers around the end of the wide receiver three range into the wide receiver four tier, and they're being split by like decimals of a point or a couple of points, because it is so thin. A catch, it literally one play could elevate a guy from at the end of the season from wide receiver 30 to wide receiver 23. And you look at it and the context of that player changes massively. We saw it a couple of years ago. I can't remember who it was, but someone caught a late touchdown in week 17 to elevate them up into that wide receiver two conversation. And it changed. And then you hear it the next week or the next season. It's like, so-and-so finished as the, you know, as a wide receiver two. And you're like, yeah, we did it on the last play of a really meaningless game. Like, he wasn't there all season. Kyle Rudolph is another example. I think a tight end. He had a monster week 16, I think. And a few seasons back, and he went from being a tight end 25 to tight end 8. And it was like, oh, well, you know, he was a tight end 1. You're like, yeah, one good game. And he just elevated it because it is so close at stages. When you have elements like that, do you just tell people, or do you, when you put your aim, do you think it is what it is? And if I miss, like if I have a guy who I think is going to be wide receiver 30 and he's wide receiver 50, like it is what it is because it's that close? Or do you have ways that you're pretty good at this thing and you rank very highly and you do this, you know, better than most on the planet. How do you get it to the point where it is so close? You go with those decisions to get it right at least a significant amount of the time.
Yeah, I hear you, Murph. And when we're splitting hairs like that, I mean, it sounds strange when you pride yourself on precision of rankings, but sometimes you just kind of throw your hands in the air and say, you know, there's really not much separation here. And, you know, if someone's asking me which person I prefer, I'm telling them, look, I'm not giving you this choice with any degree of confidence. I think maybe this guy has a 52% chance to outscore, you know, player A has a 52% chance to outscore player B. It comes down to that sometimes, and that's really the best we have to work with. You maybe offer some theories why, oh, I think this team's going to be slightly more pass heavy and neutral game scripts, or, you know, I don't like the other receivers as much on this guy's team, which is why I think he might get a little bit bigger target share than player B. But yeah, sometimes we are really just sifting through the grains of sand and you know, hoping to find little bits of information we can use. But there's, as you mentioned, sometimes it's just not much separating two players.
And again, I guess in that case, it's going back to what you know versus what you don't know. For example, if you've got a proven commodity over an unproven commodity, you probably give the edge to the guy you know is going to deliver versus the guy who could deliver, where it has all the talent and upside, but the situation's a bit more ambiguous. For example, maybe fade players that are associated with rookie quarterbacks. I guess those sort of things help you make those tiebreaker decisions. Are there any sort of major ones if you had people who were doing rankings at home and were in that close to a dead heat? Like, well, I've got a couple of guys here, all in a group that they could use as a tiebreaker.
Man, like I always, athleticism is a big thing for me, especially the younger a player is and the smaller his track record is, the more I'll look at like the athleticism, but, you know, not to the exclusion of college achievement, of course. It's all sort of part of the resume. Boy, I mean, that's really just dependent on any number of variables, Murph. Kind of hard to pin those down, and it sort of depends on the position too. Another one, I mean, I think the obvious one is like hitch your wagon to good offenses. I mean, if you're close on two players between, you know, the New York Jets and the Kansas City Chiefs, I can't think of who might be in a similar tier, but if you're choosing between
Mecole Hardman and Corey Davis or Denzel Mims, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it makes a little more sense to go for the player in the prolific offense. So, you know, touchdown likelihood is a big thing. And if you're talking about a team like the Lions or the Texans, who are destined to be one of the bottom 10 offensive teams, if not bottom five, you know, you've got to be projecting a pretty big share of the carries or targets to have someone from one of those teams ranked in the range where you would maybe expect to start them a fair number of times in the season. So, generally better to tether yourself to strong offenses.
I think that's, yeah, great advice. We're going to come back to this because I'm going to list some players. We're going to talk through where you've got them ranked, where they are versus consensus, about maybe a couple of the reasons why you have them over and over. And finally, we can talk about Jonathan Taylor, because the last time we were on, we were getting ready to talk about it, and I had a power cut, and all of a sudden, we couldn't talk about Jonathan Taylor. And I'm keen to hear your thoughts and talk about some players who cause a lot of divided opinions, and hear where you've got them ranked over consensus and go through that. But we are a week away from the Scott Fish Bowl, which is officially or unofficially the start of the fantasy football season, I think, for most people in the industry. Tell us a little bit about who you're with this year in your division, and what division you're in, and where you're picking from.
Yeah, so we've got the musical theme this year, and you know, going back to even high school, REM has you know, long been my favorite band. So I'm in the REM division, and you know, there's some other good analysts, Kevin Tompkins, Jax Falcone, Charles Herman, I believe is his full name. You know, I'm familiar with all those guys and have bantered with them on Twitter before, but I mean, the star of the division is an actual member of REM himself, bassist Mike Mills.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mills played in the Scott Fish Bowl for the first time last year. He's just a big sports fan, loves the Atlanta Braves baseball team. I believe he went to the University of Georgia, so he's a big Georgia Bulldogs guy. I think he's a Falcons fan. Not totally sure about that. So wow, Mills played in it last year, and he was actually in our chat for we were both picking in the ninth slot. So he was in a big group chat with all the 109s. And, you know, this year he is headlining the REM division, and he's picking number one, and I'm picking right behind him at number two. So it's going to be fun and quite an honor to be playing in a division with someone whose music I've been listening to almost my entire life.
That's absolutely amazing. You've actually got a good friend of mine in your division, Ben Burridge, at Gridiron UK. Yeah. So
that's
right.
I knew we had another Englishman in our division too. So he's already apologized in advance for if he screws us up with the time difference and is slow to make a pick. But yeah, that's we have a great division. I'm really excited about it.
He's gaming you there. I'll tell you now, he's a very active player. He's not going to do that. Ben's terrific. I play in quite a lot of leagues with Ben, and he's a sharp player. You better watch out. I think he's going to be a surprise in that division for sure. I mean, and you're picking from the two spot, I believe.
Yes.
So, you know, this year, for those who don't know about the Scottfish Bowl, so it's typically a quite a unique league in terms of scoring format. It's a tight end premium. There's some hinky scoring with the quarterback. So quarterback incompletions earn negative points. Quarterback sacks earn negative points. There's points for running back first downs. There's all sorts of scoring in there that makes it a real challenge. This year, Scott has added kickers, which it's not kickers as you would know it, because it's actually points for field goal yardage. So for example, if someone kicks a 39 yard field goal, it's 3.9 points. Is that? Yeah. So all of a sudden, having those that kick indoors and kick a lot is a significant advantage at the position. So again, there's another element to get involved rather than just picking a load of guys at the end of the draft or picking them up off of free agency. So with that, with the 102, you're obviously in the group chats. What's your sort of thinking from that slot? Because I guess it's really tricky. You would expect, I guess, in most leagues you'd say CMC would come off the board first. I don't think that's going to be the case in the Scottfish Bowl. So what are you thinking is going to happen in those first two picks? And I don't want you to give away who you're going to pick, but just what might be in consideration for you there, and talk a little bit about maybe potential roster construction and what you're kind of thinking your team build might look like.
Yeah, I don't mind giving away strategy, Murph. So I have seen in the Scottfish Bowl mock drafts that the top three have typically been, and I can't remember the exact order. I think it was Christian McCaffrey, Patrick Mahomes, and then Travis Kelce, because we've got tight ends premium scoring, where normally for running backs and receivers, it's half a point for a reception or a first down. For tight ends, it's a full point for a first down or a reception. I tend to not like the build of my roster when I go tight end early. I actually did it last year with George Kittle. It didn't really work out from a health perspective, which was kind of the story my entire season. Actually, I had a lot of injury issues.
I was with you there.
Yeah, so I've pretty much narrowed it down to either Patrick Mahomes or Christian McCaffrey, and I'll have to see which guy our friend from REM takes and leaves me with. So he's making that choice for me. And I have sort of not been real aggressive with quarterback despite the super flex format in past years. So part of me would like to get Mahomes right away and maybe not have to worry about picking that second quarterback anytime real soon after that. Part of me would also like to get that super premium running back, knowing full well that it's going to be a parade of running backs going after my pick, and that by the time it gets back to me late in the second round, there's not going to be much in the running back one, running back two category remaining. So one of those problems is going to be solved and one is going to be exacerbated depending on what Mike Mills does in front of me. And as far as strategy, the other twist this year, Murph, is the third round reversal. So instead of me getting that late second and then coming right back with an early third, there's going to be a little space between my second and third round pick. So I'll have to rethink that a bit. But it did not escape my notice last year that my now colleague at Football Guys, Anthony Amico, was the very last person in a 1,200 person Scottfish Bowl draft to take a running back. And Anthony Amico was the leading scorer in the regular season last year. So he pounded the wide receivers. And I tend to think there's value at wide receiver. People perceive that the Scottfish scoring increases the value of running backs and tight ends. And I think they also operate under the faulty assumption that receiver is deep. I mean, it's deep that there are a lot of people you can plausibly throw in your starting lineup. It's not deep that there are a lot of receivers you can plausibly throw in your starting lineup and expect to get a lot of points from. So I have a feeling I'm going to have a pretty wide receiver heavy build this year. And boy, if someone wants to leave Stephon Diggs or Tyreek Hill for me at 211, I would only be too thrilled to take one of those guys.
See, I think it's very tricky. So I'm in the Who division because it's my favorite band. So just like you picked your favorite, I picked mine. Andy Behrens in mine from Yahoo. So it's been fun getting to know him. And a lot of we got a lot of first timers in our group, which is just amazing to see. And I'm at the 106 because exactly of that third round reversal. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, last year I picked at the 12 spot. And I was like, I want to be on the turn and I want to try and force action. And actually, you find out that's not possible because there's so many different strategies in play and there's so many different things. And the problem is if you go for a position and then, for example, you fade quarterback and then it gets pounded, you really are struggling. And then you're so far behind the eight ball at quarterback, you almost have to fade quarterback completely. And then just pick two guys up. And it didn't really work out well as a build. And then everyone I picked got injured. So similar to you. So I thought I want to go in the sixth spot because third round reversal doesn't really make a difference. It doesn't impact the way I can look at the board. Now, I know typically people don't like to pick in the middle, but I think this year's a pretty good year for it. Not just in the Scott Fishbowl, but in most leagues, because for me, it's fascinating. There seems to be this consensus as we always get the top few picks. And then you get this run of running backs in normal leagues. Don't know what's going to happen in the Scott Fishbowl. I'm kind of contemplating. I'm looking at the 106 thinking it might be Lamar Jackson or Dak Prescott at that position and take a premium quarterback. And then looking at that 207 pick and thinking, and in the mocks they've been doing, Darren Waller falls there. I think, well, there's part of me that likes that build. But then it's, as you say, you don't get that premium running back. So when I've been doing those builds in the mocks, I've been getting, I've done it a few different ways. I've been getting Chris Carson as my running back one. I don't know how much of an appetite I have for Chris Carson being my running back one. Given the fact that I have no confidence he's going to play 17 games this season. So then you're sitting there thinking, you do get Michael Thomas and then you get a few really good pieces later on. But yeah, I think it's a struggle. But I have had in those mocks Dalvin Cook fall to the 106. So then you think, well, okay, do you pass on the elite quarterback? And I've done builds with Cook and Waller there. And then your running back, your quarterbacks end up being Kirk Cousins and like Big Ben, for example, which isn't ideal. It's a real head scratcher. It all depends on when the QB runs happen. Because I've seen some mocks where you can see seven quarterbacks come off the board in round two.
Yeah.
And I've seen some where it's like two. So it's an interesting philosophy. But I do like the 105, 106, 107 spot this year, because I think that's the spot at the moment where there's an element of control in the sense of nothing's going to get too far away from you in any draft. If there's a huge run, you've got that opportunity to pivot. You've got that opportunity to get on board if there's a guy in your tier. So I think likely if you're thinking about running back, if you're looking to do like, say, a running back starting build, you can get two pretty good guys there that you'd be very happy with. Maybe like a Zeke and you follow that up with maybe like a Gibson if he's still there, and like a Zeke Gibson start in a normal league would be quite a decent start. And then you can pound wide receiver, or, you know, you could get a top guy in the second round. I mean, with all the uncertainty, Devontae Adams is falling almost into that range. I think he probably will fall into that range. So I quite like that spot, but it is tricky. And last question on the Scott Fishbowl scoring. Have you thought about when you might take a kicker?
I have. I probably will take one, and I might even be somewhat aggressive about it because there are penalties for missed kicks in this one. And, you know, you don't want to be the guy who's starting Mason Crosby in the game 2-3 years ago when he missed, what, 4 field goals against the Detroit? Yeah,
five, was it five? Yeah. Missed a lot.
So, so I think there are a limited number of kickers I would want to consider. I would want someone super accurate, Justin Tucker, Jason Sanders, Matt Prater, Younghoe Koo, you know, guys who are not streaky as far as missing kicks. So I would, you know, definitely. And I think there was someone who posted about this and indicated that in a typical game, kickers under this scoring format could score pretty well relative to a third receiver type or a committee back type. So it's, I think it's worth considering the starting a kicker in one of the flex spots. Like there's something worthwhile to that. And, you know, I'm not going to be too embarrassed to be one of the first guys to maybe pull the trigger on a kicker.
No, I'm with you. I'm saying this to one of our 5-yard colleagues earlier, that he was thinking, well, what I might do is just fade kicker and just pick a couple of guys because there's guys going undrafted. I'm like, I think that's a big mistake because I think there is a significant advantage. There's a real tier of kickers. If you get one of those top three guys, it's a significant points advantage. I think it's now this scoring format lends it almost similar to the tight end kind of situation where you've got a very elite group at the top that's very small. A couple of guys, maybe. Then you get this drop into guys who are solid and they'll do a good job and you're quite happy to have one of those guys on your roster. And then you just get this pit of everything else.
I am very much looking forward to seeing fantasy Twitter erupt this season when people lose to the team that had the kicker who kicked 6 field goals or when someone loses because of the kicker who misses 3 field goals. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch the emotional tides based on kicker results.
Let's put it this way. Imagine if the Scott Fish Bowl is decided on a missed field goal on Monday Night Football. Like, can you imagine that? What that person would be feeling like knowing that they've lost because they, or inversely, their kicker makes a 54-yard field goal to win the game, the final kick of the season.
And somehow I think Scott Fish himself would be very delighted. And we have to at least mention, Murph, what an amazing thing Scott Fish has built. I mean, it's now got a record number of entrants, 1,900 or 1,920, I can't recall. There's even a Scott Fishbowl satellite that has an equal number of players in that. Like, it's become popular. I mean, you know, I'm playing with a member of REM who wanted to get in, and there are other actors, and it's just become such a cool thing. It goes to a charitable cause. Scott Fish used to have it be for Fantasy Cares, which sort of fed into the Toys for Tots charity that bought Christmas present for underprivileged kids. But last year, Scott sort of expanded it because there were a lot of social justice charities launching. And he just said, you know, make a donation to the charity of your choice and the name of the Scott Fish Bowl. And, you know, it's just such a cool thing that, you know, everyone is having this much fun playing in the Scott Fish Bowl, talking about the Scott Fish Bowl, and yet it's also raising money for a good cause.
Absolutely. And listen, if you didn't get in this year, do keep applying. The field expands every year. So even if you didn't get in this year, play in the satellite, get involved. I'm going to be on the Podathon, which is something I never thought would happen. But Sal's going to let us loose. Luckily, you know, they do it for 24 hours and someone has to come on at the 4:30 Eastern time slot, which for me is breakfast time. So happy day. So I'm really looking forward to being part of something I've watched for years and never been part of. So it's going to be terrific and support it by any means. And I'm lucky enough to have benefited from meeting some wonderful people through playing this and being part of the wonderful thing that Scott Fish has built. But adversely, I think probably the greatest thing of it is the amount of charity leagues that have now come off the back of this. You know, we do one, lots of other great folk are doing charity leagues all over the place. And now, you know, we're talking about raising hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of pounds for charity every single year. And it's like, we're all just giving back in some great way, a small but great way, that, you know, what we're doing is impacting lives just by playing fake football. It's amazing. Really, we can sleep well at night knowing that we're doing some good with our sickness and our hobby. So let's talk about some players who, you know, some rankings of players who you might have ranked. And let's start with Jonathan Taylor, because we never got to have that debate in full. Where, you know, when last time you were on, you were very bullish about Jonathan Taylor and about, you know, his finish and this, he can be that bell cow. And do you still have that belief that he is, you know, a strong RB1? Where are you got him ranked right now? What are your kind of thoughts on it? Or have they changed as the offseason's gone on and you've sort of dug into it a bit more?
So right now I have him running back 5, you know, behind McCaffrey, Cook, Kamara, Derrick Henry. And then I think it's kind of a tier below those four. It might even be two tiers of two in those first four, with McCaffrey and Cook sort of on a tier by themselves, and then the Kamara-Henry tier. Then I think there's some ambiguity with the next group, which is Jonathan Taylor, Saquon Barkley, coming off the devastating, the unholy trinity of knee injuries with the ACL tear, the MCL strain, and the torn meniscus, yeah, I think it was. And then Ezekiel Elliott, who, you know, didn't look great at times last year, but, you know, as my buddy Rich Rebar pointed out, did have a better success rate as measured by Football Outsiders than Tony Pollard did. It's just that Tony Pollard broke a few more big plays, much higher percentage of big plays. You know, and you could throw some other people there, Cam Akers. Some people are getting back on the Joe Mixon train after being, you know, burned by him in the past. I guess the fair criticisms of drafting Taylor in the top half of the first round would be, what does his usage in the passing game look like, especially now that Philip Rivers, a guy who really liked to throw to his running backs, is no longer there? Does he lose any carries with Marlon Mack returning, who, you know, when we opened the season last year, we saw Mack playing ahead of Jonathan Taylor. It might be problematic that there's never really been a running back to make a successful return from a torn Achilles. Like, it's the history of that has not been great. And, you know, I don't think there's much question. Taylor's a much better back than Marlon Mack. So I'm not too worried about that part of the equation. I guess what you can say is that there's a pretty safe floor there with a guy who is as talented as Jonathan Taylor was. We saw that with his phenomenal second half of the 2020 season. We saw that in 3 amazing college seasons at the University of Wisconsin. The talent's just not, you know, you can't question how good Jonathan Taylor is. He's an amazing player. And he's going to have one of the best offensive lines in the league. So running back 5 might seem too high if there are some concerns about the usage. But I think the way I like to play, you know, I don't want to whiff in the first round, Murph. I want safety, and I'm okay with drafting. I mean, I guess I don't want to be drafting 5th or 6th in typical one quarterback leagues. It's a really tricky spot. I'm okay with drafting Jonathan Taylor 5th or 6th and having him finish RB10. I can live with that. You know, at RB10, I'm still starting him every week and having a lot of really good weeks from him. I just don't want to whiff. And I think, barring injury, Taylor is pretty whiff proof, pretty bust proof.
See, I can't take Taylor over Zeke. It's just, there's just no way in my universe that can happen. And by the way, I'm a massive, when he came out of college, I was about as big a Jonathan Taylor fan as there was. He was my RB1 pre-draft. And my issue with him is the usage. It is the fact that what we saw down the stretch was phenomenal, don't get me wrong, but came with unique opportunity to, you know, first of all, there was no Mac. And I don't think Mac's a big thing, but he's a thing. They didn't have to re-sign him. They could have bought anyone off the street, but they bought Mac back, which says to me there's a role for Mac. There is going to be some role, whether it's a 20% of the role, 15% of the role. It's not going to eat out of Nyheim Hines' share. I think he, what he is locked in. And I think that's my worry for Taylor. And the way that Frank Wright, coming from that Doug Pederson tree of, I don't have to have one back. And it's the same thing that, you know, it's the same reason I've got the same, I had the same knock on Miles Sanders. I don't doubt the talent. The talent is there. It's about, with the way that the coaches scheme and the way that they utilize and value the position, I can't see that workhorse. I think you're right. I think he, you know, he is a relatively safe commodity to finish a low-end RB1. If he finishes, as you say, in that 10 to 12 range, I think that's likely to happen. I think then it comes down to how you want to play the game. If you want to play with that conservatism, and I'm a bit like that, I can understand that logic, I think, a lot more than drafting him as the RB5, thinking he's going to be the RB5. Because I don't see a path to him being the RB5. Unless Hines and Matt go, then all bets are off. This guy could probably be the RB1 based on talent with that line and everything else.
And we know that Zeke does have that track record of finishing as a top three guy in multiple seasons. I guess the one thing I would maybe push back a little on, the other great selling point with Zeke is just that Dallas should have one of the best offenses in the league. Provided they get a little bit better injury luck on their offensive line and with Dak, obviously. The one thing I might push back on, Jason Garrett loved to pound Zeke. He loved to give him 20 plus carries a game. Back when Mike McCarthy was coaching the Packers, you know, there used to be a free Aaron Jones hashtag on Twitter.
Yeah,
you know, he sometimes frustrated people by the amount of work he gave to Jamal Williams. And Tony Pollard has shown he's pretty good. So maybe we see a little Tony Pollard cutting into Zeke. I don't think there's a committee situation brewing in Dallas. No chance of that. You know, and the other thing is that just Zeke has some mileage on the odometer. It's, you know, he's been used heavily. Some guys age better than others. I'm not really downgrading him because of that. I am a little concerned that he didn't always look that sharp last year, but again, there were a lot of problems with the Dallas offense overall. I mean, Andy Dalton sort of shrinks the field and brings those safeties closer to the line of scrimmage, and the offensive line was dealing with a lot of injuries. So totally understand it. I basically have Taylor, Zeke, and Barkley on one tier lumped together. I, you know, can't argue vehemently against anyone who wants to take any of those three over the other two. So, you know, I totally understand the point.
And I think our first four are pretty similar, you know, McCaffrey, Cook, Henry, Kamara. You know, I think, you know, as you say, I think for me, McCaffrey's in a tier of his own. I think it's a pretty easy 101. I think Cook is in a tier of his own. If you don't get McCaffrey, you take Cook. I think that makes complete sense. Kamara and Henry, that's just, I think, down to how you want to play it up. And maybe, you know, and some people are fading Kamara, fearing Taysom Hill's going to get the job and what might happen. I kind of get that because, you don't want to whiff on that. But I think, I don't think that's going to be too much to worry about. So then you're going to have this run. We expect sort of eight running backs potentially going off the board in a row at the start of the draft. And then you're starting getting into this conversation of wide receiver Travis Kelce, I think, goes in the first round now, which I understand. I never really was for that. And I'm pretty similar to you. I don't play that way, but now I get the positional advantage that Travis Kelce gives you over the rest of the field, and the fact that he's a top five scoring wide receiver in his own right, and it's a safe floor. I get that now. I didn't in previous years, but now I kind of get it. What about Davante Adams? What's going on with, you know, with Aaron Rodgers? He's, I mean, everyone's kind of, you know, you're a Green Bay fan. I personally don't, I'm not worried about Aaron Rodgers. I think he's going to play. I think he's going to play for the Packers. I can't see him retiring. I can't see him getting traded. I don't think he's there that long. I think this could be the last season, but I, you know, we're only talking about this season. Are you worried about the Aaron Rodgers situation? And as a result, are you going to fade Adams, or are you thinking this is just going to be one of those things that everyone's made a big deal out of, but actually it's just going to get resolved and go away very quietly, very quickly?
I think I'm less worried about the possibility of Rodgers leaving, or I think it's less of a chance than a lot of people. I think it's 80 to 90% likely he starts for the Packers in week one. I just read there's apparently some sort of contractual clause or something. I don't know, an NFL rule. Like if Rodgers decides to, by the end of this week, I think it's July 2nd is the deadline, he could just say he's not going to play in the NFL this season, and it would somehow protect the vast majority of his contract remaining. So it would save him like more than $10 million. I don't think that's really Rodgers' first concern. I mean, he's made a lot of money. He's going to make a lot of money in his future years. He's probably going to make a lot of money in hosting Jeopardy or doing whatever after his NFL career. And he's about to marry a Hollywood starlet. So in Shailene Woodley. So I don't think money is really an issue for him. And I don't think a trade is likely. I mean, this is just sort of my own theory on this, but the Packers have this unique ownership structure. They've got a general manager who answers to a team president, who is part of a 7-member executive committee, which is a subset of a 40-some person board of directors. It's who are representing fans like me, Murph, who actually has a stock certificate that I was given for my birthday like 20 years ago.
That's amazing.
It is. So, it doesn't really allow me to call any of the shots, but I kind of think it would take a lot of consensus among all these people at the top of the hierarchy in the food chain in the organization to let a second Hall of Fame quarterback leave under unhappy circumstances. Brett Favre already left unhappily and went to the Packers' most hated rival. I'll say it. I hate the Vikings more than I don't even hate the Bears. I do hate the Vikings. And seeing Favre go to the Vikings and then beat the Packers in his first start against them as a member of the Vikings was just like one of the worst moments of my Packer fandom ever. I don't think they're going to let Aaron Rodgers also leave unhappily. I think Matt LaFleur and team president Mark Murphy have already flown out to try to mend fences. And I think ultimately Rodgers is not going to hold out. I just don't see him doing it this late in his career when he knows his biological clock is ticking. I think he still has things he wants to accomplish in the league before he crosses the age threshold into his 40s, and there's not much time.
And also, let's get this right. Like, he's not going to Denver. Like, he's just, I get everyone's excited. They got great offensive weapons. Nobody's dream is to go and be a quarterback for Vic Fangio. Like, that's not a dream. That is not something people want. And this whole thing of him going to Denver, I don't get it. I get it if a team, like, for example, if the 49ers hadn't drafted Trey Lance and they were really in it and that was a real conversation with the fact he's a Californian kid and that team is it's a great roster. If we were talking about the 49ers and not Denver, I'd go, do you know what? There's probably a bit in that. I can see it. I can't with them. I can't imagine he'd go and uproot his life. And I know Green Bay isn't big, and I know it's not like, you know, it's a very small place, and I know Denver is bigger, but that team's not ready to compete. It's in a division that they got virtually no chance of winning, even with Aaron Rodgers. I don't see it. It's not like, I just think this is, as you say, he's got limited time left in the NFL. And I don't think he's going to put his future career at risk of being a quote unquote complicated fella like that. I don't think he's going to put his future revenue at stake, because no one wants to be the guy who holds out and holds a team to ransom. You know, it's not a good look. You run down your contract, you go to free agency, people get that. You know, Tom Brady did it. No one resents Tom Brady for, after 20 years running, you know, getting the free agency and picking his move away he wanted to go, because he did it the right way. He told the guys, "I'm not signing a new deal, I'm off." It makes sense. But anytime someone holds out, it never goes well. Lev Bell has never been the same player since he held out. Like, it doesn't go well, and he won't be received well as a host of Jeopardy or whatever he wants to do. Is, well, you held out for a year because you got upset that the franchise drafted your replacement 2 years early or whatever.
Agreed. And you know, I think Brett Favre is, there's still some Packers fans who hold a grudge against Brett Favre. Oh, and Murph, just to answer your question about Adams. So he, of course, would have been my wide receiver one had he had this Rodgers thing not come up. I'm hedging a little bit because I think Stephon Diggs and Tyreek Hill are close enough that if there's any sort of ambiguity, because Lord knows it would be a disaster for Adams if Jordan Love were quarterbacking the Packers in week one, his chances of finishing in wide receiver one range would be severely diminished. So I am hedging a bit. I dropped into wide receiver three between behind Diggs and Hill, but you know, a small hedge. I mean, I know some people that have dropped him out of the top 10 thinking like a trade is imminent, and I think that's silly.
Yeah, I mean, judge it when it happens or if it's about to happen. Yeah, I get that. I've still held firm. I've still held him as one. I'm treating that situation as I saw it during my projection process, that Aaron Rodgers is going to be a Packer. He's going to play this season. What happens after this season is another question. Anything can happen, but I'm happy to keep him at one for now. And as you say, if this is still dredging on in preseason, I will rethink the situation, but I think it will get resolved at some point. Let's talk about guys going just after. So if you look at where Adams is now, he's going sort of in that second round. You're getting a nice discount on him. If you want to go zero RB and you're at the tail end of the first, you could win the lottery by getting either one of Kelce or Diggs and then picking up Adams after that. I mean, it's about as good a position as you can be if you are a zero RB truther. But let's look at guys going just after that. So Antonio Gibson, Austin Eckler. What are your views on these guys? Because personally, I find them very difficult to differentiate, even though they're obviously very different backs. And I know you've got sort of Cam Akers in there as well. But I know Antonio Gibson's kind of going after Austin Eckler, but do we think that they are, I don't know, what are your thoughts on them? Because I personally think that right now, Antonio Gibson going as the RB13 is just a little too soft. Like, I've got him significantly over that. I think it's a discount, whereas Austin Eckler's going at RB10.
Yeah, I think I initially had Eckler ranked ahead of Gibson, but I've since reversed, and now I've got Gibson at 11 and Eckler at 13. The interesting thing, Murph, about Gibson is that I think people believed, given his unique background in college, that he had, what, 30-some carries, that people thought his way to find himself in the NFL was going to be as a third-down back, as a passing-down guy, and that eventually he would start to grow into a larger share of the rushing duties. I mean, very unexpected that it wound up with him being the primary rusher for the Washington football team and was not the primary passing down back, that J.D. McKissic got all this work. So obviously, like, pass catching is something he can do and do well. Like, there's this college resume he has of having done that. And yes, J.D. McKissic is still there. I do think it's reasonable to think there's going to be more passing game work for Gibson. They didn't really add any significant talent at running back in the offseason. I mean, they have Jared Patterson, who some people liked as a prospect, but he's sort of a poor man's Devin Singletary, a small back who doesn't really catch passes, or at least didn't in college. So, what we saw from Gibson was just so spectacular last year. I know the expected, the touchdown count was greater than the expected touchdown count based on a number of the people who do that based on, you know, how many carries a player had and where they were on the field and what running backs typically score from certain points. Like, I know he outkicked his touchdown expectation. But this Washington defense is really good. I think there might be more favorable game scripts for Washington. They might be able to run the ball even more frequently than they did last year. And he's just an exciting talent. I like Eckler too, but I think the rushing upside is limited because I think they always want someone to share that rushing load with him, whether it's Justin Jackson or, Josh Kelly, who wasn't that good as a rookie. No. They spent another draft pick on Larry Roundtree from Missouri. So I think one or two of those three guys is going to be mixed in along with Eckler. Eckler's going to own most of the passing down work. It's a healthy role. I have no problem drafting Eckler at or near the first, second round turn. Really good player, safe. You know, barring injury, I think he's a safe asset. But, you know, he's just, they're not going to give him 250 carries. It's just not going to happen.
No, exactly that. And I'm with you. I think Gibson's role, and I think the one piece is that he was behind arguably the worst quarterback play in the league last year. That's going to change with Ryan Fitzpatrick. You know, they're going to move the ball a lot. It's going to be a lot of yards scored on that Washington offense. I do like the fact that, as you say, they're going to get ahead, they're going to defend, and then they're going to run the ball. So I think it's great. I love Eckler. I'm happy to take Eckler in the second round. I just think, as you say, he's safe. PPR formats, he's going to put up good numbers. In standard, it goes down a little bit. But as you say, pretty safe workload. He's going to be involved in everything. And I think he'll rebound back from the injury well. In between those guys is Joe Mixon. As you say, obviously he's burned people in the past, but they still haven't added. In fact, they've decreased from their backfield in the sense of the experienced backup Giovanni Bernard is now with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They don't have a lot of experience behind Mixon. You have a couple of sixth round draft choices vying for the backup role. Behind him, and you have an exciting offense there. At the fact that now, I think last season Mixon was overpriced. I think, we're talking about he was going at the 109, 110. You know, clearly that was never going to return the value. I faded him heavily because of that. I didn't believe he was there. But now he's available mid-second, late-second. I'm somewhat interested because I think the upside is there. And if I've got someone who I know is steady, dependable, and safe, I'm perhaps slightly more inclined to gamble, given the fact his range of outcomes could be anywhere from a top four running back to, an absolute bust through injury. So what are your thoughts on Mixon?
I think I have a similar view of him, Murph. I think we're of one mind on this. Yes, he's burned some people in the past. It's nice that Giovanni Bernard is gone for him. Like, that's, it opens him up for a greater share of the running back targets there. I don't know that there are going to be a ton of running back targets given how good the receivers are in Cincinnati, But then again, at LSU, we saw Joe Burrow throw to Clyde Edwards-Helaire quite a bit. So, you know, it's nice that he doesn't have that top-level backup, although people have been talking up rookie Chris Evans as a, you know, nice prospect. But, I mean, come on, he's not going to challenge Joe Mixon. It should be a pretty good offense. I do worry about the offensive line. You know, they had a chance to improve it by taking Penei Sewell over Ja'Marr Chase. They chose to go with the receiver. You know, a lot of people like that they chose to have this just ridiculously good group of receivers. And maybe I've heard it reasoned that helps Mixon more because no one's ever going to crowd the line of scrimmage and the rushing lanes are going to be bigger. It actually, you know, is better than having a really good offensive lineman. Not quite sure if I buy that, but so yeah, there are reasons to like Mixon. Health has been a bit of an issue, so I'm a little bit nervous about that. I'm a little bit nervous that the offensive line isn't great. And I'm a little bit nervous that game scripts aren't always going to be positive and run friendly for the Bengals this year. And also that they've shown a proclivity to be very pass heavy and neutral, game script neutral situations. So I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of on the fence, but I do think early second round running back 14 is there. It seems like that's a good spot for him.
Yeah. I think the thing that gives me a bit of confidence is, you know, prior to him going down, he was the running back 4 on the season. He had some very good games early on in that lineup with Joe, you know, with Joe Burrow. Obviously, the unfortunate thing was he went down, I think, week 4, week 5. Like, it was early, but, you know, he did really come out of, I mean, I think week 1 was pretty poor, but weeks 2, 3, 4, 5 were really strong, really strong performance.
Either week 4 or week 5 was that 3-touchdown game against Dallas, whose defense was just a train wreck at the time, and Mixon ripped them apart. Yeah, I think that was the highlight of my Scott Fishbowl season, an otherwise disastrous season. I had Mixon, George Kittle had like 200 yards that day, and I think I had Odell Beckham go for 3 touchdowns that day too.
Didn't he throw one in that game?
He did throw one. So that was a crazy week, and that was Mixon's big game that really pushed him up the scoring. But yeah, then I think it was the next week that he got hurt after that Dallas game, and but yeah, you're right. I mean, it looked pretty good in early last season for quite a while, and maybe we'll get that again over a longer stretch of time this year.
Yeah, I sure hope so. I do like him as a player. It's just, again, whether or not you can put it all together for 16 weeks. Let's talk about Tennessee for a second. So AJ Brown, a lot of people were forecasting him to potentially join Diggs and Adams and Hill in that tier. Now they go and get Julio Jones. Have you downgraded? He's going off the board now, wide receiver. Well, his expert consensus ranking is wide receiver 7. Do we think that's fair given Julio there, or is that being too conservative?
I think that's being far too optimistic. I know a lot of people said that they weren't going to move AJ Brown down their rankings, or at least not significantly after that trade. I think it's because people just really like AJ Brown, Murph, and they sort of looked for excuses not to. Like, yes, Julio Jones is going to be there, but oh, Arthur Smith is no longer the offensive coordinator, so they might not be as run heavy as they were. You know, this new offensive coordinator, Todd Downing, I think his 1 year as an offensive coordinator with the Raiders in 2017, the Raiders were top 10 in percentage of passing plays versus the run. I think people were sort of manufacturing excuses not to fall out of love with AJ Brown. He is an efficient receiver. I mean, he's good at the catch and run, which really boosts his yards per target and yards per route run and those efficiency numbers we like. But there's no way he's not going to be hurt by the arrival of Julio Jones. I mean, we could realistically maybe have expected up to, what, 180, 190 targets for him when he was the sole credible receiver in that offense. And, oh gosh, I'm blanking on the name. Who's the Rams receiver who was going to be
Josh Reynolds?
Josh Reynolds. Thank you. So I could see the optimism then, but there's no way that Julio isn't going to be a major part of this offense. And oh, by the way, Derrick Henry is your running back, and he is going to command his 20 plus carries a game. So, I've got Julio down at wide receiver 20, AJ Brown at wide receiver 12. I mean, in an offense that's going to run the ball too, I can't see how I can move either of those guys higher. I don't think AJ Brown should be a top 10 guy. And, I've got to keep Julio in wide receiver 2 range.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you on Julio. I have him at 21. I'm slightly higher than you on AJ Brown, but not much. I have him at 8. I think that we resonate here quite a lot, because I think with AJ Brown, I think he still gets his targets. I think he's going to be getting his portion. I think Julio helps him than not having anyone, because I think it would have been very, very easy to cover AJ Brown knowing that the guy on the other side is Josh Reynolds, which right. is not going to scare anybody. You know, you could put AJ Brown in triple coverage and literally could take him out of games, because it's like, okay, and he's a good player. He's a very good player. But he's not playing the slot, and he's not playing that sort of role where it's easy to manufacture touches to. I think the fact that Julio is there means he's going to get open a bit. But yeah, I don't buy this, wide receiver 1 hype. And I think as well, credit to Tannehill over what he's done over the last 2 years. He's been terrific. But, you know, people do not wait enough. The change in offensive system does not always bring an upturn in fortunes. And the Titans are a great example of that. You know, it'd be great the last 2 years with Arthur Smith. But look at Marcus Mariota behind that. You know, he had 3 different offensive coordinators in 4 years. It didn't help him any. And I think when you change the offense significantly, it's going to be difficult for them to, as you say, we're a run-first team, to really give AJ Brown the ball enough for him to be the standout sort of wide receiver 1. But I think he'll be fine. I think he's a safe-ish play, but I don't think he's going to have those peak weeks that I think when I look at players around. If I wanted a safe player in that range, I'd take Allen Robinson, for example. I think if that's your choice, it's like, if I want safety, I'll take the guy who does it every single year with worst quarterback play, knowing that he's actually might get a better quarterback this year, and he might even be better over someone like AJ Brown. I think I don't see that upside that people do. I think he's a safe player. I don't see I don't see him having wide receiver 1 overall weeks.
Right. And Allen Robinson is one of the guys who I moved Brown behind. I'd previously had him ahead of, I think off the top of my head, Allen Robinson, Keenan Allen, Terry McLaurin, and there might have been one other receiver.
DK Metcalf.
What's that?
DK Metcalf.
I already had Metcalf ahead of Brown, I think, one spot. Or did I? Yeah, they were neck and neck before. But I mean, it's not like it trashes his value by any means. But without that massive target upside, I just think it's going to be a little harder for him to capture his potential ceiling. Even though, as you pointed out, I think his efficiency numbers are probably preserved by the arrival of Julio Jones helping to command some more of that coverage and not keeping AJ Brown bracketed by defenders all season.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one, but I'm definitely not buying the hashtag AJ Brown wide receiver 1 story that your league mate Kevin Tompkins is going to be spilling, as he has done all offseason. So let Kevin Tompkins and the Scott Fishbowl take AJ Brown as his first wide receiver and you outfox him that way. Last couple. So there was a bit of a debate, last year and in the start of this offseason, J.K. Dobbins versus DeAndre Swift. At points, it looked like Swift was going to have the advantage, and then Matt Stafford gets traded. They signed Jamal Williams. They've met with Todd Gurley, and I think they've kept that one on ice. I think that one happens. And then you've got a really complicated backfield again in Detroit. And then you've got J.K. Dobbins, who showed at times what an elite runner he is. But with the way that Baltimore play with their offense, it's unlikely he's going to be given the full role and responsibility of being the true back that he is. How do you have those guys ranked? Do you think they're going to be on your teams a lot this season? And you know, what are your kind of thoughts on those two? Because I think they're a real quandary in terms of what's available in that sort of third round.
They really are. As of now, Murph, I've got DeAndre Swift running back 16 and Dobbins right behind him at running back 17. And I know some people would maybe think that's too aggressive. And I know there are other pockets of support for these guys. They're kind of in similar situations in that they've got veterans who are going to cut into their loads. I mean, we've seen that the Ravens like to use Gus Edwards. I think the Lions have kind of made it clear that they're going to use Jamal Williams. And now there are rumors that they might sign Todd Gurley. I'm not sure if that's going to happen or not, but, you know, even if it's just Jamal Williams, like Williams, we talked about the free Aaron Jones hashtag before. Williams is, I didn't like him very much his first year or two. I thought he was kind of a jobber, just sort of a guy. And, he grew on me over time because he really does everything well. Like he blocks aggressively. He can catch passes. He can run inside and out. Like he does everything pretty well. And I mean, like Swift left no doubt in my mind about his talent last year. Like he was, when he was limited to a passing down role, he was terrific in that, other than dropping the game-winning catch against the Bears in week one. Other than that, he was really good as a pass catcher. And then as once they let go of Adrian Peterson and, you know, turned over the running game to Swift, he was really good in that role too. Dobbins, you know, goes on this run-heavy team. And I think on one hand, Lamar Jackson helps him out by being a running threat and making those holes a little bigger. And on the other side of the coin sort of hurts him by being a running threat quarterback who's going to run in some touchdowns and take those off Dobbins' plate. So plus they don't really throw to the backs too much. Dobbins is very talented. I think maybe there's a pretty safe 1,000-yard floor there, assuming he plays 15, 16, 17 games. Maybe, Murph, I shouldn't be contradicting my own advice from earlier in the podcast about how if there are two guys who are pretty close, you should probably go with the better offense, because I don't think there's much doubt that the Ravens are going to have a better overall offense than the Lions, and yet I've got Swift ranked a spot ahead of Dobbins, so maybe I should revisit it, but I guess if I'm going to pull anything out that could justify it, it's that, you know, I think Scott Barrett's research showed that a target for a running back is worth like 2.3 times more than a carry is. And I mean, Dobbins' usage in the passing game is very, very uncertain, whereas Swift is definitely going to be used in the passing game. And, you know, a couple of years ago, we're seeing Jared Goff really pepper Todd Gurley with running back targets. And we can hope for the same thing in Detroit. So, am I going to have a lot of these guys? I think I've already drafted each of them in best balls. I don't think I'm going to be overweight on either guy, but I don't think I'm going to be totally out on either guy either. I see the dilemma with these guys, and I definitely am not calling it quits on either, but you know, I'm also not overlooking some of these usage problems either.
Yeah, I'm looking at who you can get either side of them, right? So CEH, running back 15 expert consensus ranking, definitely think he's above. both these players. Then I'm looking immediately underneath, and I'm looking at Chris Carson. Sort of mocked him for his injury concerns, but I do think he's got almost no competition there. Not to mention, I think, you know, he's earned his way into a significant role. It's just whether or not he stays fit. And then you've got Miles Sanders, who I have been down on historically because of that system he's been in. But actually, I quite like this year, because I think even though Hurts is going to make it a little bit difficult for him, I just think that there's so little talent on that offense that it's going to have to run through him at some point. And then under that, you've got David Montgomery. And I'm thinking, well, you know, he's probably the most disrespected running back four in the history of fantasy football. Yes, he had an easy schedule. Yes, you know, there was no Tyreek Cohen last year. Yes, you know, behind pretty awful quarterback play, and that's certainly going to get an upgrade in the second half of the season for sure. But the one thing David Montgomery did do was pound the rock pretty well and did take advantage of those matchups. And he has a pretty decent schedule. It's not too bad this year. He's going to have a couple of games I think he's going to blank, but give me what you're going to get with David Montgomery over Swift and Dobbins this year all day long.
Yeah, that's a fascinating tier for sure. And I think you summed it up perfectly for me, Murph. That is like my, you know, running back 16. I said Swift 16, Dobbins 17. I think I've got Carson 18. I think Montgomery is 19 or 20. And who is the other guy we just – oh, and Sanders, I've got 19. Sanders is really interesting because, as you said, who else are they going to give the ball in that offense? I mean, they've added all these running backs, which is interesting, but like Kerryon Johnson, who didn't really work out in Detroit, Jordan Howard, who's got to be close to the end if he even makes the roster. They did draft Kenneth Gainwell, and I guess that's the one that bothers me a little bit, because Sanders was expected to be this passing down. Like, that's part of the appeal with him, passing downs. And Kenneth Gainwell is probably the best pass catching back in this draft. So that one bothered me a bit, but we did see Miles Sanders really take off as a runner last year after the Eagles inserted Jalen Hurts. Like, that opened up lanes. We talked about it with Lamar Jackson opening up lanes for J.K. Dobbins, and I think we saw the same thing happen for Sanders last year. So, like you, I'm kind of torn. I like that he comes at a cheaper price this year, because if they hadn't brought in all these backs, maybe if he had been more consistent and, you know, hadn't had such a sluggish start last year, he'd be a lot more expensive. But right now, being able to get him, you know, third, maybe fourth round is a little more palatable.
Yeah. You know, he's going off the board, as you say, that sort of three, four turn. And I'm with you. I was never paying mid second for him last year. I thought he was the most overpriced player in fantasy football last year. And, you know, the fact that he finished, I think, running back 24, running back 25 overall says it all. But, you know, the one thing I would say is I just think this year is going to open up for him. I think Montgomery is getting underdrafted. It's an interesting tier, as you say, and I think there's going to be some real movement in this tier, and I think it'd be interesting, because I actually think if DeAndre Swift signs if Todd Gurley signs for Detroit, I can see Swift fall like 10 spots easily. I just think people will panic there. And I also think, on strength of schedule, that outside of Aaron Jones, he has the worst schedule of all the running backs.
Yes, he's, you know, he doesn't get to go against the Detroit defense in that division. That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, even Aaron Jones gets that, and he's got a tough schedule. But yeah, I think it's a tough one for him of what he's going to do. But I think it's fascinating. I think we're going to see lots of movement over the next couple of weeks and months. And I just can't wait for it to be back. I just think it's such a long off season. It's been great with the draft. It's been, you know, OTAs and preseason's coming, and we're going to have an extra game this year. How are you, just a quick one before we let you go. How are your leagues adjusting to this extra game this year? Have you seen much, done much with it? Have you kind of left things as they are this year?
So it worked out pretty well. Two of my home leagues are 14 and 16 teamers. The 16 team league, we actually had a 14 game regular season and played a week 17 championship, which I know would incur the scorn of most people. But, you know, we, our thinking on that was like, traditionally it really hasn't affected week 17 results as much as people would believe that it would. And we kind of felt like one extra week of the regular season for 16 owners outweighed this idea that like somehow a week 17 championship game wouldn't be fair to one team or the other. And I'm kind of glad we've done it that way over the years, but now, like now it works perfectly where we still get our 14 game regular season. We're still not playing in the final week. It's perfect. And our 14 team league sort of works similarly well. But yeah, with other teams I've heard, or other leagues, I should say, I've heard people thinking about doing a 2-week championship game, adding playoff teams. Some are just going to take the last 2 weeks off, which seems, I don't know, self-defeating. I suppose if you want to have a multi-week free-for-all with all the teams after the normal season is wrapped up, that would be cool perhaps. So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, Scott Fish, who runs a lot of leagues, would probably be the better person to ask about this. He might have more creative solutions for better utilizing that extra week. But yeah, it is interesting, and it's going to be interesting if they inevitably throw the 18-week season at us the following year. So,
oh, that's coming. I'm almost ready for it. That,
yeah, I don't think they want an unbalanced schedule where teams play one more home game or one more road game. Right. That just, it's kind of silly. So
they might just do the reversal for next year just to tidy it up, and that might happen. It might be 18 next year, might sure. be, but it's not gonna be long. Absolutely not. But this has been an absolute pleasure as always. I'm so glad that you came back and joined us, and look forward to the next time you're on. But before you go, tell everyone where they can find your outstanding work and your amazing podcast, and tease maybe perhaps who might be on this week.
Sure, Murph. Great to talk to you as always. I always love our conversations, and already am looking forward to the next one. People can find me on Twitter at Fitz_FF. They can find my rankings, pre-draft rankings and in-season rankings every week at thefootballgirl.com. In-season, they're always posted first thing Tuesday morning. Even first thing if you're in the UK, because I know the football girl herself usually gets those posted before she goes to bed on Monday nights. And I'm also going to have a lot of content up at footballguys.com. So I would encourage people to subscribe to that. I mean, there's so much on that site. It's well worth it. And as you mentioned, Murph, the weekly Fitz on Fantasy pod, that usually arrives Tuesday morning, Wednesday at the latest. And this week it's going to be our mutual friend, Mike Tagliere.
Oh, fantastic.
So, I'm a little mad that Tags moved out of the Chicago area, so I'm not going to see him in person quite as often. We used to golf every week right after Labor Day, right before the start of the season, because we knew it was going to be like our last non-crazy day of the year. But yeah, good conversation with Tags that I just wrapped up less than an hour before I came on with you. So I think people are going to enjoy that.
Yeah, absolutely. He's such a fascinating and wonderful person. So did you give him much stick for not being verified on Twitter yet?
It came up.
I'm not sure. We had Joe Pisapia on a couple of weeks ago, and obviously he's hosting, and he is the mediator between Kyle Yates and Mike Tagliere on that show at the moment. And I don't know. I don't understand how he's not been verified. Someone needs to sort that out. We'll start a campaign after his ego's been bruised a little bit.
That's right. Got to come up with some sort of hashtag for that. No question.
We'll do it. We'll work on it. But Pat, as always, thank you so much for coming. Look forward to having you on again soon. Rush Nation, check out the rest of the podcasts we're putting out over the course of the week. I think some of the guys, I think the Dynasty Pod will be giving away an FFCC spot. So tune in for that on Wednesday. The DFS guys have rolled up and recorded an amazing podcast. So check that out when it's out later on in the week. Don't forget to check out all the content and everything we're doing. We've also got the unique day giveaway. There's prizes and all sorts. So check that out on Twitter. It's donations of 3.12 and in divisibles of that to win some amazing prizes. So check out the pinned tweet on that. But until next week, where I hope Stocks returns, and if not, he doesn't, and I'll have to call another friend up to come and join. Don't forget, keep rushing.